From an early age, we're all immersed in sport. For some, it fails to ignite a spark inside us, but for those of us who catch the fire, it's the beginning of a lifelong journey filled with highs and lows, which all matter far more than they should. After all, it's just a game, we're told. Sport is a certainty, it's a point of reference in an increasingly uncertain world, and the bonds formed with either sport in general or a hometown club transcend both time and generations. Today, much of what sport has always meant to true fans has been somehow lost in a blizzard of corporate communications, fireworks, and froth. The attachments that were once so strong seem more trivial in the global age of televised sport as entertainment. What was once authentic has become increasingly staged. In this podcast, we'll get back to the things that sport has always meant to true fans. We'll take you from the boardroom, to the dressing room, to the pitch, but we'll do it not as a corporate communication, but as true fans of sport, and we'll do it with authenticity. We'll be honest, and we'll speak our minds. This is a podcast for true sports fans, and the one thing all fans have in common is a passion for the game. Now, we certainly don't mean to cause any offence, so if you find yourself taking any, just shrug it off and get back in the game, because this is about the game, and the game is bigger than all of us. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Are You Not Entertained? And our final episode of what has been a tumultuous year in sports. Joining me, as always, somewhere in the Cayman Islands is producer James. And presumably, near the lake, if not in it, Roger Mitchell. Are you there, Roger?
Yes, I'm in Como. Survived Christmas. Wonderful Christmas here. And lovely to hear from both yourself and James for the last episode of the year. What a wonderful year it's been.
Yeah, it has been. It has been fantastic. And, you know, so much to look forward to in 2020. And you know, the guest we have joining us this week, and we're going to waste no time getting into this because
I
think we've got so much to talk to this guy about. This one could go on for a while. So, Roger, why don't you just let everybody know who is going to be joining us?
Well, Joe Markovsky is one of the senior executives of DAZN, which is the pure play sports over the top broadcaster that has morphed out of the previous business Perform. Joe has been with the company from the start and broke the Japanese market for them very successfully, and then was sent over to the US to do the big game with the new people involved there, including John Skipper, ex of ESPN. And they've focused as their main sport on boxing as a target to be disrupted. They do a little bit of MLB as well, but it's not the main rights. And of course, they partner in this whole exercise with the Hearns family, who probably are one of the most aggressive disruptors in sport of the last 30 years. And Joe will tell us about how he got there, Japan, what's happening with America, the models, KSI, Logan, the younger generations. And as you say, Grant, I think we just get straight right into it. So welcome, Joe. Welcome to the show.
How are you guys doing?
We're good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you.
Let me introduce you to my co-host, Grant Williams.
Okay. Hey, Joe, how are you? Thanks for doing this.
No, not at all. Nice to meet you guys.
Likewise.
So Joe, you're a London boy. That's correct, yeah?
Yeah, I'm from West London. I grew up in sort of around Ealing, Chiswick, that sort of area. Was at school in Hammersmith, where our HQ now is. So, yeah, very much a London guy. Did 2 years in Tokyo between 16 and 18, and then I've been in New York since the start of 18 in my current role. Yeah.
So, Joe, you know the style a little bit of what we do here. Before we get into the nitty gritty of the discussion, we'd like to understand a little bit about how you got tuned into sport from a kid onwards. Were you a football guy? Were you a Chelsea guy from that part of London, or what was your passions?
Yeah, I inherited a following of Chelsea from my grandfather. He grew up on the White City estate. Not too far from where I'm sat currently, actually, in White City now. But he grew up on that estate and was a big Chelsea fan. Used to, well, at least talk about jumping over the fence to get into Stamford Bridge when he was a kid. So I sort of picked up a following of Chelsea. I never was a particularly passionate soccer fan, actually. I was more of a cricket guy and a rugby guy. My dad was a pretty good basketball player, played sort of semi-pro in the UK. He likes to tell tall tales of going over to the States and almost making it, but I don't think in truth he was ever quite at that level. But he's a big, big sports fan, and you know, he played a lot of golf. I played a lot of rugby and cricket at school. I think probably the result of going to some rather posh West London private schools rather than playing too much football. But it was a big sporty household, and cricket and rugby remain my sort of sporting passions to this day, really.
It's that classic London sports upbringing. I notice, Joe, you've been in the US long enough to refer to it as soccer, which is something that happened to me in my time in the States too. Do you get a lot of grief from your mates back home?
Yeah, I do, and they'll probably, some of them will probably listen to this if I whack it on LinkedIn and give me some more jit. But I think, it's one of those things. You've got to, I get equal amounts of jit for calling it football with my American friends. So whilst they're in the States, I'll speak in Americanisms, and as and when I come back to the UK, I'll hopefully carve those Americanisms out of my vocabulary. But for the moment, I'll call it soccer.
Oh boy, listen, we speak both languages on this podcast. So listen, you and I share share a common experience in that we both spent time in Japan. Talk to me a little bit about your experience. You know, I went to Japan a lifetime ago, 30 odd years ago, and I found it the most strange and wondrous and magical and frustrating place to be. But it really opened my eyes up to how different the world is. I mean, I was in the world of finance as opposed to sports. But just tell me a little bit about your impressions of Japan and the kind of the impact it had on you moving over there.
Yeah, look, all of the above were things I think any Western expat living in Japan would describe the country as, especially the working culture there. Japan was launched, I think, 10 days after our first market launch in Germany, Austria, Switzerland. So basically at the same time. And I was very involved in the original sort of business planning and market launch planning for Japan. So even prior to moving there in 2016, I'd spent probably 18 months with James Rushton, our CEO at the time, and John Gleeser, who I'm sure many of you are familiar with.
Yeah, not John Wayne.
Sort of planning that launch. Yeah, lovely guy.
Beautiful guy.
And very experienced in the Asian markets. So him and James were, at the time, the two most senior his own staff, and some growing the management team now. They both remain in senior roles in the business. But the three of us and a couple of others sort of planned out that launch. James and I in particular were very involved in the pitch for the J-League rights that ended up being sort of heartbeat of our launch, Japanese launch sort of plan. So, and the first sort of major supersizing of his own market at those rights. So I had a good taste of the market before moving there, but when you move there, exactly as you described it, you're sort of, as a Brit, or probably as I imagine as an American, growing up in a major economy and in a country that feels at least like it's the absolute center of the world, you quickly realize that there's a whole complete other world out there. There's probably several other worlds out there, and Japan is definitely one of them. So I quite quickly realized I was in a completely different market. I quickly realized that in the sports media sort of community, it's quite a small industry over there. So as a young guy, I was probably 27 at the time, maybe 28. I saw a great opportunity just to sort of learn about how a whole industry in one market operated. Getting to know all of the key people and key businesses, there's probably 8 or 9 of them over there, some bigger than others, obviously, but an extremely interesting sort of professional experience. On a personal level, it's a completely different kettle of fish to the UK. There's not a big expat community. There's definitely not a big young expat community. So my social circle was my girlfriend at the time and the 5 or 6 Western guys and girls we worked with. So we had a quite a tight-knit, close group of friends, and we had a great time. It just was, extremely fulfilling professionally, huge opportunity to go and learn new things and prove yourself as a young person. You can't really ask for much more than that as you're trying to sort of establish yourself in a company. But at the same time, as you said, at times, incredibly frustrating because they have a certain way of doing things. They have a certain culture. It doesn't always marry well with fast-moving young businesses, especially foreign ones. So we had to marry a sort of business plan and a set of expectations from management that were going to change the world in 5 minutes to a certain extent. Which is a great energy the zone had and still does to a certain extent, with a culture that doesn't necessarily always want to move that far. So the sort of marriage of the two, and obviously doffing your cap to the environment you're in and respecting the way that they do things whilst also trying to bring about change, was a challenge I found really, really exciting, and one that has definitely helped me as I've moved on and moved to the States. It was a great professional and personal learning experience. I miss Japan. I miss it. I haven't been back actually since I left, but I've got great friends there, both Western and Japanese, and I'm very much hoping that I'll get back to Japan on holiday in 2020.
It's fascinating. I do have this fascination, like you. I mean, I left Japan a long, long time ago, but I miss it. It is a place that really gets under your skin. And I know we're going to get into the DAZN story shortly, but I'm just curious because Japan is such an unusual choice of place to open something the way you've done. You know, I was living in Tokyo when Buster Douglas beat Mike Tyson at the Tokyo Dome back in 1989, I think it was, or 1990 or somewhere around there. And at the time, that was just such a massive event for Japan. And yet it's really kind of a sports wilderness. The fanatical following that the Premier League football teams, for example, have over in Asia seems to have kind of largely bypassed Japan.
Yeah.
What was it about Japan that made you guys decide that that's where we're going to go and get a foothold?
Yeah, I don't necessarily agree with your point about Western sports or Premier League not landing there. We can come back to that. But from a business planning perspective, when we initially looked at the zone market phasing, and the board sort of challenged us, the Perform Group board as it was then, challenged us to identify markets that would make sense. Whatever way we cut the data, whatever way we sliced and diced the methodology, Japan was always top five markets, and so was Germany in that sort of back region as well, to be honest, for different reasons. In the case of Japan, there was a clear view that we held that there was a relatively flat broadcast rights market. There was, the way we looked at it, a tennis broadcaster, a soccer broadcaster, an American sports broadcaster, a Japanese baseball broadcaster, an MLB broadcaster. There wasn't much competition between the various broadcasters for rights. There was probably a high level of respect to the sort of legacy relationships that have been built by broadcasters with certain rights holders. And obviously from a rights holder perspective, they were looking at the market and going, why in Singapore and why in Hong Kong and why in Australasia are we doing 15-20% growth revenue cycle on cycle for our rights, yeah, when Japan's probably operating at single figures? And that sort of caught our attention. And at this time, we're also having lots of conversations about with our, and John Gleeson was leading most of these at the time, with our friends in the rights holder community, saying, where have you got problems? Where would you like to see some disruption? And Japan consistently came up there because it was a market not many of them understood in depth. Most of them didn't have boots on the ground there. But they all recognized that the problem we saw was of limited revenue growth cycle on cycle. So as we dug deeper, it became clear that there was, I don't want to say collusion, but there was sort of a market situation that didn't exactly drive revenue growth in the same way that other markets were seeing significant revenue growth cycle on cycle, as I mentioned. So that was the primary reason. It was availability of content, because There were a number of major domestic and international tenders coming up for Japan, so we saw an opportunity to buy content quite quickly. We can do that without paying significantly more than the incumbent at the time had paid last time out. And we saw obviously a huge internet penetration, a very digitally savvy market, and a population of sports fans who are, you know, as rabid a sports fan as anywhere else in the world for the content that they love. So I think all of those things initially blended together. Then you sort of layer in the fact that premium domestic rights were coming up shortly after our launch. We launched August 16. The J-League was available from February 17. And we did that deal sort of 10, 11 months ahead of time. So you mix all those things together and you suddenly got a really attractive market. We also saw an opportunity to partner with a telco or a distribution partner in NTT Docomo with a 45% market share. We saw an appetite from them to make DAZN their OTT sports service alongside their existing anime and music and magazine subscription offerings. So significant marketing support from a major telco with significant market share. It became a really attractive proposition. Of course, you then have to say, right, we're at that time probably 20 British people in an office in West London, not particularly experienced in the Japanese market. We had a small office there for the for media business, so we didn't have a huge institutional knowledge of Japan. But the sort of pros of doing it massively outweighed the challenges of executing that we saw. And so we just sort of got on with it. The board was supportive. They supported the supersizing with the J-League rights bid, and we won that. And you know, suddenly you're off at the races with premium domestic rights and a major distribution deal, and you've got a serious subscription business at that point.
Yeah, and you actually did a brilliant job of superbly answering the question I should have asked. I just phrased it incredibly badly in hindsight. But you know, what I was really interested in was the fact that you guys went to Japan and it was kind of a backwater, which amazes me. You know, it's 110 plus million people. They've had World Cups there. They've had Winter Olympics there. They love their sport. And I've always been fascinated as to why nobody seemed to go to Japan. You know, you guys did, and it's been very successful. And I was just interested to hear your logic, because it makes perfect sense to me, and I couldn't figure out why nobody else had done that.
Yeah, I think there's a barrier to entry in Japan that a lot of Western businesses see. It is, relative to other markets, a tougher place to operate, because it has its own unique way of operating.
Yeah.
So you probably need in Japan a mix of a business like ours, a mix of local people with, you know, significant experience in that market, and people who are experienced, those people or expats, a combination of the two, who are experienced in dealing with foreign businesses in Japan. There's a community of expats who do that. There's a community of Japanese locals who have made their careers in doing that, of welcoming and soft landing Western businesses into the market, because it is so unique and it is so different. You can't go in there naive, and there's lots of sort of case studies of businesses that have tried to go in there and sort of apply Americanized or British ways of working just straight in without any sort of tailoring. You're causing a massive problem for yourself if you do that naively. So it's probably, it acts as a barrier to entry, to be honest. And we perform and design still have a sort of, the way I read it, and having experienced it for a while now, we have a sort of culture of, to a certain extent, getting on with it, rolling with the punches, and learning as we go. And I think that was definitely true in Japan. There were weeks in Japan where, you know, there were 30 of us in the office group, probably 50 of us doing serious shifts on a daily basis, because there's just so much to do. Launching an OTT offering of that scale with that level of operation and technical risk is a massive undertaking at the best of times. When you're layering in sort of significant coding and translating challenges in a completely new market, a completely different language with new partners, you know, running at speed they're maybe not used to running at. It's just added stress and added pressure. So I'm really proud of what we did in Japan, because one, we took it on in a way that, you know, I'm sure lots of business models get you know, you throw Japan out, I'm sure in lots of boardrooms it's like, well, we're not going to do that. That's way too hard off the bat to start with. We got past that hurdle. We then got past, you know, sort of right operating the market domestically and internationally. We acquired the concept. We did the distribution deal. And then we went and bloody did it. And I think that for me is something that I'll always look back on incredibly fondly and with pride, because, you know, there's probably 15 of us still in the business who involved 20 of us who involved on the ground in Japan. And we sort of, you know, you still sort of talk of old times in Japan at the very start, because it was a great, as I say, personal and professional experience.
Joe, I think your explanation here merits a little bit of context from a guy like me that comes from John Gleeser's generation. You know, I would tend to say this, that you are so impressive in the way you talk about this, because in some ways the industry when we came up was a lot simpler. And what I think a lot of people don't realize about DAZN is that you're not in the UK, and you're not in the UK because you've made an assessment that it is not the easiest and most attractive market for you just now. You're very much data and analysis led. And what I want to ask you, a little bit of a personal question, is how the hell did you get so damn good so quickly? You know, and I'm not blowing smoke up your arse. I just, like, I've looked at you from afar, and you're dealing with some serious shit just now, Joe. And like, how did that all come around?
Well, I'll start with a reference to Mr. Gleeser, who still to this day enjoys walking around conferences and introducing me to people as his son, which is obviously slightly patronising, but he enjoys it. But I've got a great relationship with John. I effectively carried his bags for 4 or 5 years when I joined to form. And, you know, not to blow smoke up John's ass, but he, that was really the first exposure I had to someone, you know, at the top of a business, took me under his wing, gave me a load of opportunity. At the time, I was in the commercial side of the perform business, so managing rights holder relationships. I was sort of on a plane to and from Geneva and Lausanne every couple of weeks, managing the likes of FIBA, the Basketball Federation, FEI, the Equestrian Federation, managing their websites, managing the sort of relationship we have with them on a betting front, for Watch and Bet and those sort of you know, services, businesses that perform at the time used to run that, obviously now Stats Perform. And John, I always find it's the culture of perform at the time. I still think the zone retains this, and I say this to lots of young people in our business now. It's one of those businesses where, because it was so young, and John, obviously, who won't mind me saying this, is probably at the older end of our sort of population of staff. But John and Simon and James Rushton, even that, they're all in their sort of mid-40s eldest now. So 10 years ago, and I joined, these guys are in their sort of late 30s, mid-30s. They'd come out of businesses like IMG and Octagon and places like that, and they had basically just, as a group of young guys, just gone and built a really impressive business that, you know, it was 5 or 6 years old when I joined it, 7 years old maybe. So they had this sort of culture, built this culture of best idea wins, I think is the best way to describe it. You were, as a young person, once you proved that you could handle your day-to-day stuff and, you know, make sure the client relationships were ticking over and data reports were being sent and websites weren't crashing under your management. As soon as you've done that and you sort of, you could run with a ball in your hand, they let you just run faster and faster and carry more and more. So that was one, you get the exposure to projects and to management and to clients that maybe in some other businesses you wouldn't get a sniff of at the age of 23, 24. And then, you know, once you're in those rooms, if you had an idea, you weren't ever afraid to express it. You may occasionally get, you know, a slight look out the corner of the eye if it was slightly off. But obviously you pick and choose what battles you fight at that age. And in that environment, if you're young and hungry and occasionally have a good idea, you're gonna start getting more and more opportunities. So there was that sort of founding, and I was lucky that I sort of landed at that at the right time. And then the business just grew, right? This is where I feel incredibly lucky. Perform just kept moving faster and faster. And people, I mean, my mates saying, what are you doing going out to Felter every day in your mum's car? We're all in the city working at this law firm or this financial institution or this marketing agency, going out for beers on a Thursday night. And I'd be driving back on the A316 from Felton sort of 8 p.m. thinking, I wish I was having a few beers with my mates. Then you realise actually you're in a really exciting environment where you're given exposure and opportunity, and the company's growing and growing and growing. And then the zone just sort of came out of left field. I was doing an MBA at Imperial College, which is one of the best things I've done in my sort of career to date. Just great exposure to part-time, so continuing to work and putting that sort of stress on myself made me more efficient professionally. It also exposed me to sort of a bigger and wider world of business, met some really interesting people, learned some interesting theoretical things. And as I sat down with John to start thinking about what dissertation I might do at the end of that, after sort of 18 months of study, he said, well, the board have got us looking at what a subscription sports broadcasting service might look like, sort of think Netflix, think Spotify for sport. Why don't you do some research on that?
Wow.
So that was just absolutely perfect timing. I'm going to give my dissertation in. I gave my dissertation in, I think, mid-December. And in the sort of semi-hungover conversation I had with John and a few others mid-morning after arriving in the office, having to finish my MBA, they said that the board had signed off that morning that the sort of original investment plan in what is now the zone for, I think, 150 million euros. So timing, which is like stars sort of aligned, and then I expressed an interest in working in the original the zone team, and there was five of us, and we sort of carved ourselves out with some day-to-day stuff and just got on with lots of whiteboard sessions, lots of spreadsheet sessions, modelling and landing on things like where we launched first, why Japan made sense, what content we could buy, where we could buy it. So I just feel all of those things have massively given me a very, very solid platform and exposure. Walking around Sportel with John for 2 or 3 years, you meet everyone. Everyone knows who you are after 2 years of doing that because you're John's bag carrier, for lack of a better phrase. And then I've run with it since. And I feel very privileged to be a part of the original Perform Group team, and then obviously the Zone team from the start. It's been fantastic.
I think Joe, you're very modest. You know, it's all very well that the timing is there and you get the opportunities, but if the dissertation hadn't been good, or the thing that I want to ask you about now, when you said about the best idea wins, DAZN, I think, took a step change when it brought in Skipper, who for the people that don't know, basically grew ESPN to what it became. A senior guy, huge gravitas in the sports industry. And young Joe Markovsky, best idea wins, says, do you know what? Why don't we, if we're going to focus on boxing, think about doing influencers? How the hell do you have the balls to do that, Joe?
I can't take full credit for that. Eddie Hearn has to take credit for the original seed planting there. Obviously, I found myself in the States. Skipper joined, I think, 2 months after I got there. He's been fantastic. He's got to back me from the very start, and the team that we've built in New York also brought in some of his old pals from around the US industry have been great as well. Jamie Horowitz springs to mind immediately. But look, it just, for me, it just made a lot of sense that Eddie obviously had the sort of very skeptical view when KSI and Logan Paul, who are the two sort of preeminent YouTubers from the US and the UK, Logan Paul being the American, KSI being the Brit, they fought in an amateur fight in the summer of 2018, and Eddie had a chance to get involved in that. He sort of turned his nose up at it, he won't mind me saying that, and dismissed it as a farce, sort of white collar farce that was sort of best kept on YouTube. But it did 1.3 million pay-per-view buys on YouTube globally, which in the context of a boxing fight is big numbers.
Huge.
Very few pay-per-view events do seven-figure numbers. We talk about like one or two a year, if that, in the last 10 years. So that caught his attention. He presented the idea of, look, we're building out a schedule. We should think about this. Not immediately. We should think about this for 2019. And John and others sort of looked at it and said, we've got no credibility. We're a brand new boxing broadcast. We can't just come into the US market announcing ourselves as a proper boxing broadcaster and do this. Obviously, John, you know, isn't of the generation who consume YouTube content, creator content, particularly. Didn't know who these guys were. I think a few of our management were of the same mindset. And I think there was a position that we needed to build a proper boxing schedule before we sort of dipped our toes in that water. So I just, with Eddie, just kept pushing it and pushing it. And I just kept sort of trying to plant the idea, because I thought, we've got ambitious growth targets. This is a completely new set of subscribers. You are not going to buy a Anthony Joshua or Canelo Alvarez fight. Very few of these guys are going to be in that sort of addressable market. So it's a completely different audience of consumers. And obviously, when you're trying to build a subscription base, you want to find pockets of consumers, you know, as many of them as you can to de-risk your numbers, right? So kept pushing it, and eventually we struck a deal that was led by the Matching Boxing USA guys. And we met with both KSI and Logan Paul and their respective management teams, and we built a great relationship. And I think John remained skeptical all the way through into fight week. didn't know what to make of it. But then the buzz, as soon as we were in Vegas for the Canelo fight the weekend before, and I remember getting to LA and just sort of locking my head into KSI Logan Paul mode after a Canelo Alvarez weekend, and just thinking, bloody hell, this thing is huge. And the social numbers, we put out a how to download, how to watch video with Logan Paul. We did something like 4.7 million views. This is like an instructional video of just, this is where you download it, this is where you, what button to press, basically. And it did 4.7 million views. And you're thinking, bloody hell, that makes it in the top 30 sports videos on the internet this year on YouTube.
Joe, what I think I wanted to bring out for the listeners here is specifically this. It's you leading what I call quite a profound change for sport. In the past, sport broadcasting was put it out, build it, and they will come. I think you and DAZN have changed the mindset, which is, let's take sport to where these young audiences already exist, rather than trying to drag them to us. And I don't think a lot of people have yet understood that, Joe.
Yeah, well, I think that's a very generous description. I think we are trying to, very, very candidly, we're building a subscription business, right? We're trying to attract new subscribers. We recognize that our platform and our way of distributing content appeals probably slightly more readily to the younger generation than it does my father's generation, for example, definitely my grandmother's generation. So it makes sense to work with partners and build events that attract that audience. I also think we have a service to deliver to the sport of boxing. Boxing has done itself no favors in the last 30 years. The pay-per-view model in the US in particular, you know, $80-$90 a pop 4 or 5 times a year, on top of a very expensive cable subscription of maybe $200-$220 a month for a top sports package, means that the cost of watching boxing, I think, I'm not wrong in saying being a boxing fan in America is the most expensive broadcast fandom of any sport anywhere in the world. Might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's right. What it's done is it's just reduced the number of people watching boxing. When I was 23, living in my post-university flat in London, me and my mates would genuinely think about spending 20 quid on a Anthony Joshua pay-per-view, whatever there was at the time, Scotch Groves maybe. So we think about it, because it's a lot of money when you're earning not much money. In the US, it's 4 times that money, on top of a cable subscription that's probably 4 times the cost of the UK Sky package or BT package. So the cost of being a boxing fan is huge. Young people just simply are not watching boxing As a result, the audience numbers and the interest in the sport have declined. So we have a responsibility to the sport of boxing to try new things to grow the interest in boxing. And I think KSI Logan Paul 2 is the first of many things you'll see us try to do that. And I don't think it will be restricted long-term just to boxing. But no. Primarily, whilst we are in the USA boxing-led broadcaster, it's an obvious place to start. We had the proof of concept with their first fight. We've announced the Jake Paul fight for January the 30th. That is the younger brother of Logan fighting on another DAZN Eddie Hearn card. So we're going to do more of it. And I think boxing will be the first part of it. But I personally see huge upside in applying this model to different sports. Because in an age where I think you mentioned that you've got young kids, all my mates who have young kids, my colleagues who have young kids, say that the sort of distraction that these kids have available to them now in entertainment terms, not just in sport, is so, so widespread that sport as one genre of entertainment has got far more competitors than it did a generation ago when I was growing up, for the attention of young kids' time. And we've got to marry words together, sort of Venn diagram of influencer, YouTuber, and real sport to I think for certain sports to remain relevant and to capture the interest of people whilst they're young and building out their sort of sports fandom that will last generation upon generation. So that's really my approach to it. And I think we've proved the concept. KSI Logan Paul was a tremendous success. We learned a load of things, what we could have done better, what they could have done better. We've got a very open dialogue with those guys of building relationships in that community. And as I said, we've announced one more. I think you'll see us announce many, many more of these things in the coming 12 months.
Yeah, I mean, I think to make your own point, to your point, I got into the first fight through my daughter Valentina, who is from the YouTube world. And she's obviously not a boxing fan, but she got into the whole vibe. And then the second one, because of that. So here's a couple of questions from her, because, you know, she's your future. She's the future of the industry. You know, you, Joe, I think almost uniquely are completely involved in this popular culture that's developed with these influencers and KSI and Logan Paul. Her question is this. What is the difference in the personalities between the two of them, and who did you actually think won the second fight?
In terms of personalities, they're both very, very business savvy. And I think that surprised me. They're not just creative types who don't understand the business side of it. They both get it. They both speak marketing language. I remember just immediately being struck by how inherently they understand the subscription business model of acquisition and retention and customer engagement and brand awareness. They just inherently get that and spoke that language immediately. They both surrounded themselves with very bright people. They've got tight circles who are, I think help them navigate through what inevitably is a pretty crazy lifestyle they lead. So that's sort of similarities. KSI, I think, is a bit more chilled. He's quite relaxed. He's very funny. He's got a great laugh. British sense of humour. Very relaxed, laid back, self-deprecating, just good guy. Through quite British characteristics, really. Yeah. Logan Paul, probably a bit more bombastic, life and soul, quite loud, quite energetic. But very good fun. Got a great friendship with a guy called Mike Maljak, who's sort of his co-host on a number of different content productions. So he lives in a big house in LA and likes inviting people around to have meetings and do podcasts. And I think just sort of lives that sort of all American lifestyle, but just sort of cut out for the YouTube world. I definitely think I was in Japan when Logan had that unfortunate incident in Japan a couple of years ago. I remember thinking sort of what a prat, immature, moronic thing to do. and I've discussed this with him, I'm actually struck by how mature he is for a guy in his mid-20s. I think that he's spoken to me about this. I think that whole experience matured him. When you're cascaded by the internet and the media around it, on a global scale, and forced to apologize and realize you've made a horrific mistake. We will do that when we're in our early 20s. We'll do that in our teens. But being sort of having that play out on the internet in front of the world must be obviously an entirely different experience. And I think he speaks about that sort of whole experience waking him up and the need to mature. And whilst I think his character, his internet character that he plays, is probably still not dissimilar to that guy who's making that content then, on a personal level, sort of off camera, I'm 6-7 years older than him, but he feels old for his age. I was very impressed by that. Even if you look at him physically 2 years late, like 2 years, he looks like a different guy.
Yeah,
true. And I think he's massively, he's changed and he's grown up, and I'm on very good terms with him. I think he's a really smart guy, and I think he's got a big future, whatever he chooses to do, right? He's got his YouTube stuff, he's got his podcast, he's got his emerging sort of boxing and athletic career if he wants it. There's so much he could do. It'd be really interesting to see what both of these guys do, because they have an amazing platform, and they've proven now, this is what really interests me, they've proven an ability to say, right, I'm now doing this, be it boxing, be it whatever else, I'm going to pick up my free-to-air YouTube audience and drop that in a transactional behind-the-paywall environment, and you're going to come and watch. And that's a really, really unique ability that not many people have. So what they choose to do, how they choose to commercialize it, who they choose to partner with, will be really, really interesting. And I see a lot of upside to our businesses and working with both of them going forward, as well as their communities, because they are definitely the sort of linchpins of their respective UK and US YouTube communities.
Joe, you just staying on boxing, but moving away from kind of the present and the potential future, I want to talk about boxing, as it used to be and as it's developed. You've had the 70s, where a golden age of boxing with Ali and Foreman and Frazier and those guys. You had the 80s that were ruled by Tyson. You had the 90s where you had some great middleweights. The kind of 2000s was a bit of a wilderness for boxing, and I think your point about the cost of pay-per-view was spot on, and it came at absolutely the worst time for boxing, because there really weren't any major rivalries apart from perhaps the sort of Pacquiao and Mayweather guys. But we didn't really have an interesting and compelling heavyweight division for the first time in perhaps 30 years. And now you're seeing, obviously, the future. You're seeing UFC fighting. You're seeing the KSI Logan Paul stuff coming up. When you look at boxing as a sport in its own right, how do you think about the future? Because, again, we do have some interesting fighters once again. We do have some competition in the heavyweight division, which is always, I think, important for bringing people to boxing. But at the same time, you now have so much more competition for boxers to attract viewers from, and you've found that you can create the kind of interest you used to have in big boxing matches without traditional boxers. So when you look at boxing itself, how do you think the future lines up for the sport?
Very good question. I see you've got an invigoration in boxing now. I've heard lots of people say, oh, boxing's been reinvigorated by broadcast rights investment in the US. That's bullshit, because we wouldn't be investing in boxing collectively as an industry if there wasn't a clear moment of excitement for boxing in general. The talent's got to be there before the media dollars come, obviously. I think you've got a really, really strong middleweight and heavyweight division right now, so situation right now in both. They traditionally have been the two big levers for success in boxing. The middleweight and super middleweight division generally spurns pretty sort of competitive fights between fast-moving, skilled athletes. We have that right now. We have Canelo Alvarez, we have Danny Jacobs, we have Billy Joe Saunders, we have Gennady Golovkin, a whole load, six or seven guys, and I'm happy to say the Zone have got a really strong hand on that whole middleweight, super middleweight division. There's loads of big fights to be made there that will engage people on both sides of the pond in big numbers. The heavyweight division, almost out of nowhere, last two or three years, has really come alive. Tyson Fury's back, doing what he does best. Deontay Wilder's got huge sort of knockout power. Anthony Joshua is probably one of the most marketable athletes / people on the planet. So you've got four or five guys on top of that division, all of whom on their given night can beat the other, which means that if we could sort of as an industry cut through the politics and the sort of bullshit around boxing, the next two or three years should produce 15 massive boxing fights at heavyweight level between all of those guys. Dillian White, Andy Ruiz, Tyson Fury, Deontay Wilder, Anthony Joshua. You've got guys like Alexander Usyk coming up from cruiserweight. There's this whole range of narratives that could play out. And if the governing bodies and the promoters and the managers and everyone involved just sort of focuses on that, and it's no easy task, that should produce a schedule of fights over 3 or 4 years that could, further invigorate the division by attracting new fans and younger fans. I think, again, those two divisions are the lifeblood of boxing. I learned that pretty early in my sort of boxing journey. I also think you've got this reemergence of the glamour and the celebrity around boxing that I didn't think existed 5 or 6 years ago. Eddie Hearn deserves a lot of credit for that, because he came into the UK market probably just prior to the London Olympics. He won't mind me saying, massively aided by the fact that sort of Greek god Anthony Joshua won gold in the domestic Olympics. That massively helped the growth of boxing.
Controversially.
How he uses social media, how he himself is a celebrity for the one age, fast-tongued, sort of Essex boy done good, that has landed well in the sort of reality TV, social media age that we live in. Boxing in the UK is now a top-tier sport. I've been walking around London the last week or 10 days, and very strangely to me, people are coming up in the street and recognising me from my interviews about boxing, because people deeply care about boxing. They follow it, based on the success of Anthony Joshua, fights like Fox Groves, emergence of guys like Daniel Dubois and Tyson Fury, obviously right up there. So it's become this sort of much stronger sport now through all of those factors. And the US is probably 4 or 5 years behind it, but if the US gets to that level, the size of the population and the legacy interest in boxing and the sheer number of high quality fighters there are of all different demographics in the US, if it pops like it's popped last 5 or 6 years in the UK, then we're on to a winner for sure. And I think it will, because as I say, there's a whole range of factors that contribute to it. You need big personalities on the fighting and the promotional side. You need broadcasters throwing resources behind it, which you've got. And you need narratives that the public, both hardcore and casual fans, care about. And I think if you look at what could happen, Fury and Wilder will rematch in February. Yeah. I'd expect Joshua to fight the winner of that fight once or twice. I'd expect Joshua to fight the loser of that fight once or twice. So all of these things are there together, and I think UFC, it's worth saying, UFC has taught boxing that someone like McGregor can lose two or three times and still draw a huge audience. The sort of Floyd Mayweather school of thinking that if you lose, you're suddenly done career-wise, needs to disappear from boxing because it stops the big fights from happening. And if we can cut through all of that, the ingredients are there for a bump a few years.
It's so funny. This is exactly what I want to get into, because we had that period, let's call it the Don King period, where a lot of these big fights mm-hmm. wouldn't happen for a long time because they wanted to get the purse right. Then we had a period in the last 10 years, particularly the sort of the Pacquiao and his cohort, where they all kind of dodged the big fights until it was the end of their career and they needed one big payday. You know, it seems now with the introduction of DAZN and guys like you who are doing this, that it's actually in the boxers' interest to have these big fights. And if they do lose, they have a rematch. And you know, I think for the boxing fan, this is a spectacularly positive development because we'll see more of these big fights. And I think you're absolutely right. It doesn't matter if they lose a big fight because it just juices everybody up for the rematch.
Yeah, look, a couple of points on that. I mean, maybe the Pacquiao happened, I think it's commonly held belief, 6 years after when it should have happened.
Exactly.
Because both of them were sort of dodging and they probably blamed publicly deal-making detail. But the reality is they're both probably shit scared of losing and never getting the opportunity again. There's not much that scares either of those two guys, but I imagine losing to the other was definitely up there as one of their biggest fears. So it didn't happen. It still did 4+ million pay-per-view buys, but imagine what it would have done 5 years earlier. It's sort of odd that it's the only sport where the biggest games don't happen. Imagine Barca and the Chelsea Champions League final not happening because they can't agree economic splits. It's unique to problem with the boxing. Look, I think the other thing on the rematch sort of culture is when AJ lost to Ruiz on the 1st of June, I remember I was sat at MSG in sort of shell shock next to our CEO Simon Denyer and Eddie, and we all sort of looked at each other sort of just gobsmacked and not really saying much. Sat in a bar a couple of hours later just thinking, oh my God, what has happened? Sort of felt similarly on Sunday morning. But then I remember Lou DiBella, who wasn't involved in the promotion, he's a sort of promoter, very colourful character in the New York boxing scene, called me on the Sunday afternoon and said, that is the best thing that's ever happened to the zone in the US. And I sort of said, oh, thanks Lou, but what do you mean? Our guys just lost against a complete nobody. No one knew who he was 5 minutes ago. And he said, you're going to get a rematch and it's going to be the biggest fight of the year. And out of nowhere, we had one of the biggest events of the sporting calendar a couple of weeks ago in Saudi Arabia. It did huge business for us in all of our markets, notably the US, obviously. And you had this Mexican-American heavyweight superstar emerge in Andy Ruiz Jr., who will have a load more fights and further engage a very passionate Mexican-American boxing fan base with the sport. So AJ, I think, is the blueprint for how to handle a loss. He did it in a very gentlemanly fashion. The narrative in the second fight was make or break for AJ. It was 50 minutes of fame for Ruiz. Is it over? Is it not? Is he the real deal? And even for him now, he's going to bounce back, and the story around his next fight, as and when that happens, will be absolutely huge because people want to know if he's just a flash in the pan or if he was, say, the real deal. So there's a whole load of different narratives that come off the back of it, and I think it makes it a far deeper, far more interesting sport if, as I say, we can cut through the bullshit that surrounds it, cut through the promotional disputes and competitive tensions that exist all around the sport of boxing and just focus on making big fights. And we are, as I've said a number of times publicly and behind closed doors, we are open-minded to working with other promotional companies, other broadcasters, just to make big fights happen, because if we can do that, then our business will grow, the sport of boxing will grow, and I see the two as very, very interlinked in the US. We've got to grow the sport as well as our own individual business if we're going to be as successful as we want to be in the next 4 or 5 years.
Joe, that takes us on to a little bit the future and maybe a slightly more prickly question than some of the other ones. You know, so we look at DAZN now and you've clearly established your beachhead, but I don't think I'm wrong to say that you're not yet profitable. You're talking about maybe bidding for some of the really, really chunky, expensive stuff in the US. You've bought the Champions League in Germany. What my question is, what is the plan for DAZN? Is it to continue to, let's say, invest, I'll use the word invest, so that you can grow those subscriber numbers so that you become a wonderful acquisition target for somebody? Or do you see your future as a self-sustaining, standalone business? The context of the question being that whilst Netflix is what everybody refers to, it is a financial basket case in terms of the P&L account. So that would be my question. How do you guys see your future in that respect?
Yeah, obviously I can't comment on specific economics of our business, I think given that we are at most 3.5 years less, the oldest of our markets are sort of 3.5 years old, but less than that, we're starting to see very positive economic returns in those more mature markets. There is a clear path of profitability in the slightly less mature markets, and I think given that we know of the size of the addressable market in each of our countries, we do very scientifically, there are no fundamental concerns about that sort of journey to profitability in individual markets. Candidly, we have very ambitious growth plans in terms of number of markets we operate in, the rights we go after in each of those markets, and I think there are obviously economies to scale as we continue to grow globally in rights acquisition and marketing spend and all of the key sort of cost areas of our business. So I think what we'll see us do in the next 2 or 3 years is continue to put our foot down and grow. We've got a very supportive set of investors. We've got a very supportive and very experienced board who are very sort of reassured by our 2019-2018 performance. So whilst the sort of plays and the scale of investment in each market obviously differs, the returns do as well. And I think that we're going to continue doing what we're doing. In terms of how ripe we are for acquisition or our sort of corporate narrative going forward, I'll leave that to our corporate guys at the top of the chain to comment on. I'm focused on the US and Canada, and I'm really happy to say that we have worked bloody hard this year with the North American team, and we've come away with a fantastic set of results that are right where we're expected to be. So
perfect.
I've just got to continue, as all of my equivalents have in all of our markets, staying focused on the numbers that we're handed by the board, and continue to grow those markets with new investment in content, more efficient marketing spend, and trying new things like a couple of YouTubers having a boxing fight at the Staples Center. We're going to continue doing new things and engaging new audiences within the confines of an aggressive but economically well-designed business plan.
Yeah. One follow-up on that, which is actually our sponsor question from Smart Sports, is this one. Given that everything we've talked about these younger generations, and what would the order of fear be of the following three competitors that you have now? Amazon, Facebook, and TikTok. The order of fear.
Order of fear. Well, we work with all of those guys in different ways. So if you're defining all of them as competitors, I'd have to refer to them as frenemies rather than pure enemies.
Okay.
TikTok and the social platforms and Facebook, I don't see... I don't see particularly direct competition with. I'll actually be having a beer with my good friend Reese Beer from Facebook in a couple of hours' time. So
I'll say hello to him. He's a good friend of us. Say hello to Reese.
Yeah, he's a great guy. The social platforms, I'd include obviously the Twitters and the Snapchats, the world alongside Facebook and TikTok. I don't see direct competition is at all. We work very close with them. I think those guys are on record and sort of have a very coherent strategy about how they want to work with sports rights holders and the broadcasters. So I don't see them as an enemy or sort of a direct competitor. Amazon obviously are involved in the same tenders as us. They are Champions League in Germany more recently. Are both involved in that tender. So we'll see when that's sort of formally announced where the content lands across the board and the split of rights between various broadcasters. But I don't see in the immediate term, I'll see us continuing to work very closely with them from a distribution perspective, from a technical perspective, on their platforms and on their various devices. They carry our app and our content. Look, down the line, if we both continue on the path we're on, we're going to start directly competing. And look, they obviously have, they're a huge business with huge pockets. So they are probably one of the few players alongside us and a couple of others who could scale an international OTT business. We'll see what happens. We'll see if the strategy meets more aggressively than they have thus far in the next sort of 2 or 3 years. But I honestly don't go to bed at night overly worried about that. I'm pretty clear on the value that we are building as a business. I'm clear on the path we're on. I don't see in the markets I cover and speaking to my colleagues around the business, we are in a very strong position in all the markets we're in. And if Amazon start competing with us more aggressively, obviously we'll deal with that. We may meet each other more aggressively in new markets that neither of us are in yet in the next couple of years. But right now, we are very focused on a plan that we don't feel is hugely at risk from competitive threats. We have our key rights generally locked up in the medium or long term in all of our key markets, and we're building a very strong brand awareness and affinity with the consumers that we're going after in each of those markets. So, of course, we think about competition, but I don't see immediate challenges from anyone you listed to our business plan in the next couple of years.
Joe, I just got one more question I've got to try and shoehorn in here. I've watched, as many other people have, with total fascination as Fallon Sherrick has kind of taken over the World Darts Championships over the Christmas period. You know, this what she's done is fantastic. It's extraordinary for the sport. It's extraordinary for women. And obviously, we've seen a lot, and we've talked on this podcast a lot about the rise of women's sports. You know, when you see something like that, you see the crowd's reaction to her competing with and beating the men. You know, through the eyes of someone like DAZN, and obviously you work with Eddie Hearn that promotes the PDC Darts Championship. I mean, this must get you guys salivating at the possibilities that this throws up and the response you see to it.
Yeah, I had this interesting to hear your thoughts. I had this conversation with my dad. Do you think she might be the of any sport in the world, we phrase that, in any sport in the world, is she the highest ranked woman if you were to blend men and women's rankings together? She's in the last 32 of the World Darts Championship. So assuming that's a ranking of the current darts scene, she's top 32 at least. Is there any other woman in any other sport who'd get into the top 30 of men's sport? Like, we had this debate last night.
No.
Would Serena Williams? I don't know. No. But it's a really interesting debate. And if it really starts opening up some, you know, you talk about narratives. That's a fantastic narrative. I mean, in a sport where it's possible, a non-contact sport like darts or maybe like tennis, you can start doing some really interesting things with that. And I think I'll definitely ponder that and think about it, because it could be something you can create that would produce some fantastically engaging narratives.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, obviously, the sports where you can have a completely level playing field are limited. You know, you think of something maybe like snooker or pool, and obviously that there's a completely level playing field there. It's tough. They tried it in golf when Annika Sorenstam was at her peak, and you know she played in a men's PGA event, but the extra length was such a disadvantage. She did a great job, but there was no chance she was going to win. But there was nothing to stop Fallon Sherrick getting into the quarter semis and finalisting. And it was fantastic to see something like that capture the public imagination.
Yeah. No, I just give credit to Matching and PDC, because they constantly find themselves in these, it's not through luck, it's through knowing how to promote sports content. They find themselves at the heart of many of these sort of fairy tale stories, but sort of high interest stories, and they make the most of them, and they help grow their sport. So hats off to her and to the whole sort of PDC organisation, because that really would capture the nation's imagination. And also, ignited in the US, you know, darts is not obviously a mainstream sport in the US, and long term, we'd love to help it grow in the US. But it definitely caught the attention of the US sporting public and media as well. So, you need things like that to introduce sports to new audiences, and it's a fantastic example of their promotion and obviously her talent.
Well, look, I can't wait to see what kind of heavyweight darts matchups you guys with Eddie Hearn promoting in the coming year, Joe. It's going to be fascinating to watch. Look, I can't thank you enough for taking this time to talk to us. We know how busy you are, and obviously we're keeping you from a beer with Reese, and I'd hate to do that for any longer than is necessary. So look, if you could just let people know how to follow you on social media and stuff, that would be fantastic.
Yes, I'm on Twitter. My main one, at Joe Markowski. That's MarkowSki. That's where I do most of my tweeting about boxing and cricket. So a nice niche blend of topics there. American boxing and cricket. But look, fantastic to talk to you guys. Really enjoyed it, and we look forward to speaking again in 2020 at some point.
Yeah, look, we'll be watching you very keenly in 2020, and all the best for you and DAZN in the new year. I can't wait to see what you guys bring us.
All the best, Joe.
Brilliant.
What
thanks,
a fantastic good chat. Fantastic.
Thanks.
Very interesting. Very, very interesting.
You know, one of the things that I certainly feel, and I think a lot of people feel the same, he's a generation after me. I think he's the poster child, a little bit of the modern sports executive that is, he's out socializing with KSI, with Logan, with Jake. You know, he's become a confidant of theirs. They actually get a little bit jealous if he spends more time with one of them as opposed to the other. Yeah, they do, his liver's probably under a little bit of strain. But you can see that he's got all the data side to get, to link with the whole, as I say, human empathy of to the sports stars. And, the DAZN story is the story of our industry, the way that Netflix is for the movie business. Joe's the new generation. And I think we were very lucky to get him on the show. And I thought he was very candid and very honest. And it was absolutely enthralling, I felt, Grant.
Yeah, look, and look, perhaps most importantly of all, Rog, he's got way better hair than Don King ever had. Yeah, look, that was a wonderful conversation. I mean, again, you're right. It's good of him to give us his time. He's he's one of the few sports executives that get stopped in the street and recognised, which says a lot about what they've done and what he personally has done. Rog, you flagged this a long time ago. To give you your credit, you've talked about this for a long time about the future of this and how important things like DAZN are going to be. And as every day goes by, you're proven more and more correct. And I love the fact that we got to talk about the importance of narrative in this thing, because I think in this day and age, that's everything, right? I mean, everything around sport now, you have the fans and they're the fans. They're going to show up on a cold, wet night at Plymouth Argyle to watch Simon Hallett's team, and they're going to show up at Craven Cottage no matter what. But if you want to reach those big audiences, you need to create narrative. And this is a rich time to be in the shoes of a Joe Markowski. I mean, really, there is so much narrative out there, so many ways you can shape that narrative, and so many genuinely interesting rivalries, whether it's Joshua and Andy Ruiz, or Wilder and Fury, or even as we said at the end there, Fallon Sherrick and the rest of the men's darts team. And this is a fantastic time for this kind of business to be alive, and I genuinely mean it. I'm really excited to see what these guys bring us in the next 12 months.
Yeah, and it's not only a great time; it actually is a real test of your abilities now. You know, and one could argue that in my day, all you had to do was be really good at, having some drinks with some people and getting people to bid for your rights. And now you need to have a handle on the data side. You need to be a data scientist. Then you need to be able to spend, the small hours in a club with KSI and be able to do them, from one switch to another. And I'm just very, very impressed with him and where he's come from, because the whole Perform story is a B2B business around data and betting and everything that Joe told us. John Gleeser was a part of that. And they have just, you know, morphed into this B2C pure play Netflix or sport model, which is incredibly risky. And, you know, my question at the end about, you know, what are the numbers looking like? I thought his answer was great. I watched that with interest, you know, because it is a very, very risky business to be in. And if you get something wrong, there can be a lot of red ink. But I thought the answer he gave was very, very compelling.
Yeah, no, absolutely agree. Well, look, we've run out of time again for another week, Rog. It really does fly when you get these conversations going. So all that remains is to thank you, the listeners, for being out there and listening to us ramble on. We thank you for your support this year, and we wish you all the very, very best in 2020. Please do share the podcast, rate and review us, tell your friends, and you can follow us on Twitter. You'll find us at EntertainedR. That's the word A-R-E. And you can follow me on Twitter at TTMYGH.
And you can follow myself on Twitter at RPMComo, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Happy New Year, everybody, and thank you again for your support in 2019.
Have a great 2020, everybody.